If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Benjamin Franklin is one of the most famous names in American history. A scientist, writer, and influential figure in the formation of the United States, Franklin also enslaved people, and before embracing the revolutionary cause, did all he could to enhance the British Empire. He's the latest subject of the acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns, who's made some of the biggest history documentaries of recent years. From his award-winning miniseries on the US Civil War to a 10-part exploration of the Vietnam conflict. Ken joined Ellen Evans to talk about how he tackles such histories, where he finds the voices that bring the past to life, and how he approached the figure of Franklin.
So, Ken, thanks so much for joining us on the History Extra podcast. And the subject of your latest project is a well-known name to many. Anyone who knows the slightest about history of the United States will probably pluck his name from somewhere, even if they don't know exactly what he did. And plenty of us will probably think we know quite a lot about Benjamin Franklin. But when you approached this project, what were you expecting to find?
You know, I don't remember, Eleanor, and thank you so much for having me. I kind of don't remember the person who started this project from the person at the end, and that's the way you always want it to be. I suppose I was burdened with the same superficial information that most people have, that he was, you know, the lightning experiment and the lightning strikes the kite that didn't happen, and that he had something to do with the revolution, but he was older than most. What's so great is to discover his centrality to the 18th century full stop. That is to say, his lifespan is from 1706 to 1790, so it's there. He is, in America, the most compelling personality of the 18th century. He's our best writing stylist. He is the Isaac Newton of the world for the 18th century, not just the United States. He's the funniest person on our continent. He is a beautiful writer. He is the most important diplomat in American history. He is an odd aging revolutionary. He is having owned other human beings, becomes an abolitionist at the end of his life. He is constantly remaking himself. And in the United States, the $100 bill, which is the biggest bill that's in circulation, has his image on it because he has always been this example of upward mobility, of striving, of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, of making it on your own. And he gets adopted by people who are very much into that almost libertarian spirit of doing for yourself. What they've neglected and left behind is the equal side of Franklin, who always felt that that needed to be tethered to civic engagement. And that's what makes him so interesting. The inventions that he did, numerous, life-saving, helpful around the world, he held without any patent. He was always looking for ways to improve the general health. At the same time, he was making himself a wealthy man so that he could retire to scientific pursuits in his 40s. I mean, it's a really wonderful story, and you begin to understand his centrality. He is a huge Anglophile. He spends a lot of time in Britain. I think if his wife hadn't been afraid of sea travel, we would have only known him for his scientific things. He would not have become a revolutionary, but a lot of things made him happen. He was the most famous American. So when the Continental Congress needed somebody to try to go negotiate with the French, there was only one person on earth that kind of fit the bill of who might possibly succeed in an impossible mission. And he did.
Yes. Well, I hope we can dig into a little more of those astonishing abilities in a short while. But a thread that runs so strongly throughout your film, I think the historian Stacey Schiff says something like, whatever you say about Benjamin Franklin, you can say the opposite as well. Can we talk a little more about those contradictions?
Yes. You know, our work is famous for kind of tolerating contradictions and not having everything be binary, you know, essentially promoting that conventional wisdom or the superficial knowledge that many of us have. Someone once said to the American journalist, I.F. Stone, an acolyte who was a fairly left-leaning journalist, why he could possibly admire Thomas Jefferson, who owned other human beings. And he just stared at him and he said, because history, meaning life, history is not melodrama, but tragedy. To say complicated human being is to be redundant. And so what we have in all of our investigations for almost the last 50 years has practiced a kind of ability to tolerate the contradictions. Wynton Marsalis in jazz said to us, sometimes a thing and the opposite of a thing are true at the same time. And that coexists in all of us. Extensive greed and generosity, purience and puritanism, all of that kind of coexists between and obviously within us in a psychological dimension. So in Benjamin Franklin, in our heroes, if you will, and I mean that in a Greek sense, these contradictions and flaws and strengths are all played out on a big, big stage, but they're all intended to remind us mere mortals that we hold the same set of cards, maybe just not so brightly lit, and that we also are responsible, as Franklin felt, to improve all the time. He was, you know, several people in the film say his greatest invention might be himself. But that invention was not something of a lie or of a whole cloth. It was a perpetual curiosity about self-improvement, not just for society, his fellow human beings, but for himself. And he really lived it so that he ends up his life an abolitionist, having held slaves, having taken advertisements for the sale of human beings, having taken advertisements offering rewards for the return of runaway human beings. He's got a disparate family is everything to him and in some ways nothing to him. It's so complicated and so interesting that I think it's just human behavior writ large. And from those large, like Greek mythology, you know, Achilles had his heel and his hubris to go along with his great strength. We, mere mortals, can imbibe some, I think, really important lessons.
Yes, I couldn't agree more in terms of that message of tolerance. But I'm interested to hear from you on what sort of reception do you expect when looking at figures like Franklin in all their contradictions? Do you think it's an approach that's broadly welcomed these days, or do you expect something different?
Well, I don't know what to expect, Eleanor. It's a good question. We make the films we want to make. We work in public broadcasting, so there's not a suit telling us, oh, soften this or make this less. And I think after nearly 50 years, most Americans who might be tempted to watch will know that what's interesting about our work is all the things they thought they knew that they learned that they didn't know. And that's exciting. You know, soldiers in Vietnam telling us our Vietnam series told them things. World War II veterans before they passed away saying, thank you. I was in the Pacific Theater. I had no idea what was going on. I moved from one little spot of land in this biggest of all oceans to another little spot of land. Thank you for putting it together. And the same with those in the European theater. And so I like that. I don't make films about what I already know and then tell you what you should know. That last time I checked, that's called homework. You know, there's no test next Tuesday. This is sharing with you our process of discovery and all of the things that our deep dive over many years has given us. And then our way of, because we're storytellers, not historians. I just happen to work in history, but history is made up of the word story plus hi, and hi is a pretty good way to begin a story, or at least some human contact, is just figuring out what can survive and what can't, how to do the deepest possible dive, to not be afraid of the contradictions. I have a neon sign in the editing room, in cursive, which says it's complicated. And, you know, filmmakers, myself included, you know, you got a scene that works. You just want to leave it alone and not touch it. But we're constantly opening up scenes that are perfect and making them less perfect because there's more contradictory information. And sometimes, every once in a while, you're rewarded and you make it even better by doing that. And I love that. I love that exploration. So I think all relationships that are real have to tolerate these kinds of contradictions. If you're a parent with a child, you have to understand you don't win every battle. Life is complicated. If you are healthy yourself psychologically, you've come to accept and understand disparate aspects of your own character. So I think in the telling of stories, it's incumbent upon us to just enlarge that, and that you do not diminish the tapestry by lifting up and the carpet and seeing the dirt underneath it. In fact, it may put it in even more striking and bolder relief.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. And I think something that struck me throughout is the actions that we know him for, or think we know him for, his revolutionary activities. They're such a slow burn, aren't they? And how it is that he becomes this revolutionary figure. Can we talk a little more about that journey?
Yeah. It's pretty funny. As many people say in the film, revolution is a young man's game. And here is Franklin, whose own son is older than Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and Patrick Henry and some of the firebrands, the Southern firebrands, I think maybe even older than John Adams. And he's already lived a lifetime. He's the best writer. He's the printer. He's a businessman. He's done numerous scientific experiments that have made him the Newton, the Isaac Newton of his century, the 18th century. He's gone into politics in a kind of local way. He's been a postmaster. He's traveled. He's done some envoy work in London, represented the interests of First Pennsylvania and then other colonies. So he's a devoted and dedicated Briton. He sees the American colonies as the sort of the balance of the entire British Empire, and that he's working overtime, struggling to try to quell the passions on both sides, those who are impatient in London at the impertinent upstarts who aren't doing exactly what we're telling them to do, and the increasingly radicalized colonists who are frustrated with the lack of representation and the taxation that's being imposed to help frankly, just refill the coffers emptied by what we call the French and Indian War and what the rest of the world calls the Seven Years' War, a global struggle that played out in large but not singular part in North America between the French, the native allies of the French, and the British and their American subjects. It's hugely interesting that an accident of trying to hold things together gives him an experience that radicalizes him in the extreme. If his wife had traveled across the Atlantic, he would have spent his whole life as a Briton, and we'd known him for his scientific achievements. He, thinking that he could help calm passions on both sides, surreptitiously leaks to the newspapers the letters of a friend of his, a politician in Massachusetts. They do the opposite. It was a huge political miscalculation on the part of a person who is usually astute at this sort of thing. And he was forced to admit that he was actually the one who had done this, betrayed a friend, a postmaster who had read letters and shared letters. And he was brought before the Privy Council in Whitehall in a room called the cockpit, where Henry VIII used to have cockfights. And he was excoriated for over an hour by Alexander Wedderburn, an upwardly mobile, ambitious lord who was a prosecutor. And Franklin remained stock still, and people are jeering at him and humiliating him. All of his dreams of fortunes, of high position within the government and with regard to relations with the colonies, is evaporating before him. And he is beginning to see that his friends who he's tried to calm down were right. And so, as the historian in our film, H.W. Brand, says, the scholar, you know, he walks into the cockpit a Briton and walks out an American. And he is the person who has invented the idea of an American. He hasn't really realized it. He hasn't taken a patent. In fact, he doesn't take a patent on anything he invents. But several decades before, he's borrowing, ironically, from native groups, the Iroquois Confederation, the Haudenosaunee, their idea of adjudicating disputes with a union. And so he proposes an Albany Plan of Union and famously draws a picture of a segmented snake and the slogan, join or die. Everybody thinks, oh, come on, Ben, this is way too radical. But decades later, it becomes a rallying cry of the American Revolution. So he is seen as a postmaster that even though the interests of a Georgian in the far south of the colonies or someone from New Hampshire, as I am speaking to you from, could also share many things in common. So he's the first to see the us in the U.S. And no one has ever yet said United States yet. They don't say it until, you know, early July of 1776. And it's a wonderful story of him and his journey.
Yes, and as we've come to expect from your films, we can see a lot of those images as we're learning from the historians. The snake cut up is there in black and white for everyone to learn from. But he's a man of words, he's a man of wit. And I wanted to ask about, you've got a wonderful voice for Benjamin Franklin. How do you go about finding a voice for such a man?
Well, I don't know how far and wide the actor Mandy Patinkin has traveled. He is beloved in our country for a number of reasons. He has most recently been the stalwart supporter of Carrie in the Homeland series. And he's the boss, the control, and as Saul Berenson, he's great. And in fact, I had my youngest daughter sitting with me on the couch. She should not have been watching Homeland. I was covering her eyes at bad stuff. I was trying to explain statecraft and spycraft and geopolitical things with Afghanistan and Russia and all of this sort of stuff. And then suddenly I had this epiphany, Mandy would be great voice of Franklin. So I reached out to him in COVID. He said yes, and he was marvelous. And he called me up after he saw the finished film. He said, I had no idea. I consider this one of the three most important things I've ever done. And I thought, oh, he's going to name Saul. He said, Sunday in the Park with George, the Stephen Sondheim musical, which he was hugely important in help birthing. And then his role as Montoya in The Princess Bride. And then he said this. And I said, what about Saul? You know, he goes, that was important, but not as good as this. I've used my entire life, Eleanor, first-person voices to complement a third-person narrator and use some of the best American actors, Tom Hanks, Meryl Streep, you know, I don't need to say Julie Harris, I don't need to say anymore, but Gregory Peck and Paul Newman and many, many people. Jeremy Irons, Derek Jacobi, Alan Rickman, you know, people that have read for me over the decades and so well and so beautifully and so generously. No one had a style. I mean, you can imagine when Meryl Streep reads take one of this quote, you go, boy, that was really great. What if you did this? She goes, oh, that's a good idea. She's a lovely human being. And then she does this and makes it even better than you possibly thought. And she goes, well, wait, could I try it this way? And then that third take is even better. Mandy just put himself into the position of Benjamin Franklin. He would talk to himself. And so instead of there being take one and take two and take three, there might have been 40 different times in which he'd start the first sentence 10 times. And I just looked at the editors and I said, all yours, you know, I wasn't going to just be able to choose it on the spot as I normally do, which was the best take or parts of takes. But he put himself into it. He's, you know, he realized, oh, this is about gratitude. I need to be I'm so, thank you so much. And then he would read a sentence. He goes, no. He'd back up and he'd start it again. It was so lovely and so magical. I was sitting right here where I'm talking to you in the loft of my barn. And he was in some studio and his son was running the tape. And you never know what you're going to get. And he makes him come alive. And while there are many other voices in the film, first-person voices, it's basically a conversation between the script written by my longtime collaborator, Dayton Duncan, and by the voice of Mandy Patinkin as Benjamin Franklin. It's just a wonderful interchange and give and take between those two forces, if you will.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There is no American, besides maybe Abraham Lincoln, who is more willing to freely admit that this process of life was about a self-journey of self-improvement. Not of eliminating those contradictions, but coming to terms with them and improving on them.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Yes, definitely. And I think a point to make, which so many of the historians do in your film, is that it really does bring him to life because we know an awful lot about his personal life and his family life as well, don't we?
We do indeed. And I always felt that from my very first film, I used a chorus of first-person voices to complement the third-person because I felt that that third-person narration was just telling you, even if you were quoting and paraphrasing. But if you read a love letter, you could understand a little bit more about the style and articulation. You could make the people who seem so far away from us closer to us, realize they're a lot like us. Newspaper accounts, you know, things that were contradictory. I did a film on the Civil War and after the Gettysburg Address, which is considered the greatest speech in the American English language, you know, I think fans of Winston Churchill would have and Shakespeare would have something to say there. The Chicago newspaper said the cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, dishwatery utterances of the man who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as the president of the United States. So they didn't like the Gettysburg Address. And so you can make history come alive in a way. And in the case of Franklin, he is examining himself all the time. He is self-critical. He's Socratic first about himself, but he also has grand designs for society. He realizes that you have to have that individual freedom, but you have to have the collective freedom, not just what I want, but what we need. And he's always engaged in civic discourse and the creation of organizations. All of that. I mean, they've been editing his papers for decades, and they've still got several years to go. And they're on something like volume 43. There's a lot of evidence of what he wrote out there. And so it's funny, it's sad, it's poignant, it's instructive about who he is. And so if you've got someone who can inhabit the way Mandy does, and in the case of our narrator, Peter Coyote, reading the words principally of Dayton Duncan, our scriptwriter, you've got the possibility of waking the dead, of making the past come alive, of not making it past, but making it present. And that's, you know, William Faulkner, one of our great literary heroes of the 20th century, said history is not was, but is. And I think, you know, we bandy around these superficial things. You know, history repeats itself. It never has. We're condemned to repeat what we don't remember. The thought is lovely and important, but it doesn't apply to what happens. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. You know, and that comes closest. Human nature doesn't change. And, you know, Ecclesiastes says, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. That suggests human nature is the same. And if you are able to bore deeply into a life, however many centuries away, you have the possibility of speaking directly to our present time. And I'm always surprised at the motifs, the echoes, the rhymes of any film I've done have echoed every film, you know, nearly 40 PBS have put on. That they all speak to the present moment in some way. And so I think Franklin addresses this tension that we have. You have it in Britain right now. It's so great in politics and in Brexit and in all these things in the United States, of course, from the last president and you know, this the sense of what truth is between these tensions of what I want and what we need. And Franklin is able to marry them in a way that's positive and offers to me a refreshing kind of antidote to all of the pessimism and all of the sort of hand-wringing that until the Russians invaded Ukraine, Western democracies seem to be experiencing.
That all makes so much sense. And going back to your exploration of his contradictions, as you've already talked about, he did own enslaved people, and he worked on treaties that disenfranchised native people as well. How self-reflective was he on these inescapable faults from our position looking back?
I don't know where he got with the question of native people. He had a kind of romanticized version, which Americans have always done about native people, at the same time they were either dispossessing them of their land or slaughtering them or corralling them into reservations that didn't look anything like their original homelands. And so we're pretty hypocritical and have always been about that. And I don't think Franklin really escaped it. He talked about the lovely white and the red, meaning the Native Americans, and the whites, meaning Englishmen. He thought Germans were swarthy. But he's... he evolves in a really good way about African Americans, about Black people. He does, as you say, own people, and it's unforgivable and inexcusable to own 300, as Thomas Jefferson at least did, and to own 3 is no different. You know, if you murder 3 people or 300 people, you know, obviously 300 is worse, but they're all bad. And this is the murder of the potentiality of a human being. And that is inexcusable. And we still wrestle with this, not only in the United States, but in the world. I take special focus on this in all of my work, because we represent ourselves as somebody born under the sign that all men are created equal. And yet the man who wrote that owned hundreds of human beings. And so, you know, we're hoisted on our own petard, and our own hypocrisy and contradictions are there. So Franklin evolves. He does have some household enslaved people. We don't know whether he let them go. Of all the voluminous writing, there's no proof. We know that a couple ran off and he didn't really put up much of an effort to find them. One ran off in London, as a matter of fact. We do know he started a school for black children in North America and was stunned to find that they were as apt a learners as white students. So it's the beginning of the unlearning of these terrible, terrible aspects of his personality and life. And then by the end of his life, he is, having forged the compromises, the tragic compromises that create the Constitution of the United States and ensure that the Southern states will participate, that is the most ignoble being treating the population of enslaved human beings in the South as three-fifths of a person for the purposes of apportionment and representation, thereby ensuring that the Southern states will have a disproportionate legislative advantage up until the Civil War. And the Civil War happens, in fact, because that legislative advantage is being diminished by the expansion of states that aren't holding slaves. He, after having done that, participated in those tragic compromises that created the United States of America and its working government that started in 1789. He becomes an abolitionist, and he becomes the president of abolitionist society. And he proposes to that government that he has created, to that country he has been as responsible for any human being on earth for creating, having been the greatest diplomat in American history and negotiating the treaty with France, and then later the one-sided treaty with Great Britain in the Treaty of Paris that gave the United States its formal recognition. He becomes an abolitionist and proposes to that government that the abolishment of slavery. It goes nowhere in the Senate, the smaller house. And in the House of Representatives, it's voted down as something that the state should decide and basically ensures that the Civil War will happen. But he's there. And so what you see is a life, you know, the key words in the Declaration of Independence are the pursuit of happiness. It's the pursuit, not just happiness. And in the Constitution, a more perfect union. You sort of have a sense that all of us are flawed and that you're making yourself better. There is no American, besides maybe Abraham Lincoln, who is more willing to freely admit that this process of life was about a self-journey of self-improvement, not of eliminating those contradictions, but coming to terms with them and improving on them and trying to make that moral balance sheet, as Franklin thought. And, you know, so he took ads for the sale of human beings in his newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette. He took ads for the rewards offered for the return of runaway human beings who were enslaved in his newspaper, made money from it. And he spent the rest of his life trying to figure out what he could do to balance that moral, spiritual balance sheet. And that's really, Eleanor, admirable and interesting to me.
Indeed, endlessly interesting. It's such a fascinating evolution of character, of personal character, of personal morality, I think. How long has Franklin been with you, and what are you most excited to introduce viewers to about this man?
So the most important thing to say is that there's always another project going on at the same time, or maybe a couple of other projects. In the course of 10.5 years of Vietnam, several started, finished, completed, broadcast while it goes on. So I don't mean to say that it's 10.5 years, you know, of total singular time. But I'm thinking about him all the time and thinking about Franklin. I'd say 5 years from when we said yes to it, maybe slightly 4.5. And then he just is there, present in your mind every day. I'm excited to share him in all of that complicated. The kid, I'm happy to, for those Americans who've, you know, gone through grade school and thought they knew, I always love the best thing people tell me is, you know, I had no idea. I learned, I thought I knew everything about this, but I learned so much. Soldiers who would say that, you know, just people who had, you know, been buffs of the Civil War or something. And that's important, I think. And then for those who don't, because I'm making it for them, it's just this wonderful gift. And it's first to us. We make it for ourselves of learning this complex human being. And as I said, contradictory human being is redundant. It's just who we are. And so people make a big deal how I'm willing to, you know, show that. I said, this is the only way to tell a story. You know, Shakespeare understood this with fiction. You know, you just, there's no character there of any sort that doesn't have many facets and many complicated and mirrors the human dilemma. And that human dilemma is very simply, none of us are getting out of this alive. An exception will not be made in your case, and you will live forever. And what you do with your time here, as he said, is what really matters. You know, that the man of words, as opposed to the man of deeds, is like a garden choked with weeds.
So on that vein, then, you've made films on topics from baseball to the Vietnam War that we've mentioned, to Ernest Hemingway, another one of those fascinating characters. Apart from subjects that you don't know much about, as you said, what else are you looking for in the subjects of your films?
Well, that's a good question. And I don't know how to answer it really truly, because so much of it is emotional. That is to say, why did you pick your best friend? You know, why did you fall in love with that person? You know, you can describe the contours of it. There's a thing called a good story, and there's ideas for stories that are in our heads, my head mainly as the boss. And, you know, you think about them for a long time, and then you learn something and it just suddenly drops down to your heart or your gut and you go, yes. And you say yes. It's just, I used the example the other day of somebody's high school class, you know, that's the last four grades of what we call grade school. And, you know, just about everybody, if not by name, then by face. And you know everybody by name, half of them. And, you know, acquaintances are a quarter of them. And maybe 20 are friends and 10 are good friends. And five you'll know your whole life. Those are the films we make. At some point in the process of consideration, which is a mental thing, there are emotional, and I don't mean sentimental or nostalgic. Those are the enemies of good anything, but a kind of a deep emotional resonance that you just go, yes, you know, so you just feel. I remember being at a dinner with Walter Isaacson, who is one of the biographers of Benjamin Franklin and is in our film, and just talking to him and realizing, oh my God, I have to do Franklin. And it's as much medicine for me as it is anything else. And the team you assemble and the enthusiasms that you get, the deep dives into archives, trying to, in COVID, you know, mine the best of British institutions and American institutions all shut down, and what's online and what's been scanned and what hasn't been, and how do you conduct an interview and all of that sort of stuff. And in the end, you start whittling away, you know, and it's, we live in New Hampshire and we make maple syrup here, which takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. And we, at least on this film, it's probably 50-to-1 ratio of footage collected to what's finally used in the film. And I love that process. I'm greedy for the, you know, the creative process of it. And so it's a really unformed thing. It's just, you know, chemistry.
Indeed. And you mentioned that projects don't exist in isolation for you. Can I ask what's coming down the line?
Yeah, so we work on 10-year plans, and we're several years into a 10-year plan. The last film was on Muhammad Ali, and before that, Hemingway, whom you mentioned. We've just finished a film and are doing the mixing and the online mastering of a 3-part, 6.5-hour film called The U.S. and the Holocaust. We're doing a major series on the history of the American Revolution. We're doing our first non-American topic on Leonardo da Vinci. We've got a biography that's just opened the editing room on the buffalo, history of the American buffalo, basically the story of the people who for hundreds and thousands of generations used it from the tail to the snort, and then the other people who came in and in three generations brought it to the brink of extinction, and then those same people working with the original people brought it back from extinction. We're doing a history of Lyndon Baines Johnson, the president after John F. Kennedy, and his ambitious domestic agenda called the Great Society, of which still, like the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, his hero, influences Americans every single day of their lives, whether it's Medicare and Medicaid or civil rights bills that are now being watered down and or picked away at, or Voting Rights Act, same thing, or PBS. There's lots of things that are benefited from that. And then we're doing a history of Black life in America, African-American life from emancipation to the beginning of the Great Migration, going through a period most misunderstood, the post-war period, post-Civil War period called Reconstruction, which is seen by most people as a bad thing. It was actually a good thing. Its collapse was the bad thing, and it ushered in Jim Crow and the reimposition of white supremacy, the statues that are being debated here, the lynching, the Ku Klux Klan, and the beginning around the time of the end of the First World War of the Great Migration, six decades of African Americans leaving the South wholesale for, as the poet Langston Hughes said, the warmth of other suns. So we're just trying to come to terms with probably the most misunderstood period in American history with regard to race, and which is, you know, the central story of America. It's just maybe the world, I don't know, but it's the central story of us and the U.S., and it comes from the contradictions inherent in Jefferson's wonderful phrase that all men were created equal, yet, but, asterisk, all of that sort of stuff. So I don't know. Maybe of the 40 films, five have not been, you know, or under five have not been, you know, consciously about race, because you can't do a deep dive into American history without having to confront that if you're honest.
That was Ken Burns. His new four-hour, two-part film, Benjamin Franklin, is broadcast in the UK today and tomorrow. That's the 6th and 7th of April, and it's showing on PBS America. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.